Normally, the emperor loved to watch his troops practice, but at the moment his stomach was agitated. He hadn't eaten all day after swallowing some exceedingly bad news that was burning in his belly. Not even the best souk doctor could treat this ailment. Through his ever-diligent spy network, Shaddam had just learned that his father, Elrud the Ninth, had sired a bastard son through one of his favorite concubines, a woman whose name had not yet been determined. Over 40 years ago, old Elrud had taken steps to hide and protect the illegitimate son, who would now be a grown man, more than a decade younger than Shaddam. Did the bastard know his heritage? Did he watch with devious anticipation as Shaddam and Anirul failed to produce a male heir, child after child? Only daughters, daughters, and more daughters. 5 of them, with baby Rugi the last. Did the bastard plan his moves even now, making preparations to usurp the Golden Lion throne? On the flagstone plaza, the soldiers split into 2 groups and rushed together in a mock battle, firing a webwork of simulated lasgun tracers so they could take possession of a sculpted, roaring lion fountain. High-powered military skimmers swept past in tight formation, ascending into the clear blue sky, where the fleeting clouds looked as if they had been painted by an artist. With only moderate enthusiasm, a distracted Shaddam applauded the Sardaukar maneuvers, while quietly cursing his father's memory. How many other secret children did the old vulture spawn? It was a worrisome thought. At least he knew the name of this one, Tyros Repha. With connections to his adoptive house Talagari, Repha had spent much of his life on Zanovar, a Talagari vacation world. Living a pampered life, the man must have little to do other than dream of seizing imperial power. Yes, Elrud's bastard could cause a great deal of trouble. But how to get to him and kill him? Shaddam sighed. These were the challenges of leadership. Perhaps I should discuss this with Hasimir. But he exercised his mental muscles instead, stretching his mind, intent on proving that Hasimir Fenring was wrong about him, that he could rule without constant intervention and advice. I make my own decisions. Shaddam had assigned Fenring to Arrakis as Imperial Spice Minister, as well as giving him the secret responsibility of overseeing the development of Amal. Why was it taking Fenring so long to come back from Ix with his report? The air was comfortably warm, with just enough breeze to make the parade banners flutter. Imperial Weather Control had laid out every aspect of the day in accordance with the Emperor's specifications. Moving to a field of polygrass laid down across the plaza, the troops engaged in an elaborate demonstration of close shield fighting and flashing silver blades. 2 teams attacked, while mock enemy fire lit the square with flashes of purple and orange. In stadium boxes around the perimeter, an audience of minor nobles and court functionaries cheered politely. The grizzled veteran, Zum Garon, stood impeccably attired, his expression critical, his standards high for every performance in front of his emperor. Shaddam encouraged such public displays of military strength, especially now that several houses of the Landsrad were starting to get unruly. He might need to use a little muscle very soon. A fat brown spider dangled before him, suspended by a gossamer strand from the scarlet and gold awning. Irritated, he whispered, "Don't you realize who I am, little creature? I rule even the smallest living things in my realm." More banners, more marching, more simulated fire in the background of his ruminations. A kaleidoscope of Sardaukar moved across the pageantry field, pomp and glory. Overhead, thopters zoomed by in formation, performing daredevil aerial maneuvers. The audience applauded after each stunt, but Shaddam barely noticed, mulling over the problem of his bastard half-brother. He blew air across his lips and watched the intrusive spider swing in the sudden gust. The spider began to ascend its strand toward the awning. "You aren't safe from me up there," he thought. "Nothing escapes my wrath." But he knew he deluded himself. The Spacing Guild, the Bene Gesserit Sisterhood, the Landsrad, Choam, all of them had their own agendas and manipulations, tying his hands and blindfolding him, preventing him from ruling the known universe as an emperor should. Damn their control over me! How had his Carino predecessors allowed such a sorry state of affairs to develop? It had been this way for centuries. The emperor reached up and squashed the spider before it could return and bite him. An individual takes on significance only in his relationship to society as a whole. Planetologist Pardit Kynes, an Arrakis primer, written for his son Liet. The slithering leviathan rushed across the dunes with a scouring sound that reminded Liet Kynes, incongruously, of a ribbon-thin cascade of fresh water. Kynes had seen the artificial waterfalls on Kytane, constructed in pointless decadence. Under the hot yellow sun, he and a group of loyal men rode atop one of the towering sandworms. Skilled Fremen sand riders had called the beast, mounted it, and pried open its ring segments with spreaders. High on the worm's sloped head, Liet held on to ropes to maintain his position. The creature raced across the trackless sands toward Red Wall Siege, where Liet's lovely wife Farula would be waiting for him, and where the Fremen Council would be eager to hear his news. Disappointing news. Emperor Shaddam IV had been disappointing as a man, too, beyond even Liet's worst fears. Stilgar had greeted Liet at the Carthag spaceport. They had traveled out into the open desert, away from the shield wall, beyond the prying eyes of Harkonnens. There, met by a small band of Fremen, Stilgar had planted a thumper whose resonating heartbeat rhythm attracted a worm. Using techniques known to Fremen since ancient days, they had captured it. Liet had scrambled up the ropes with familiar moves, planting stakes to secure himself. He remembered the day he had become a sand rider as a youth, proving himself an adult of the tribe. Old Naib Hainar had watched in judgment. Back then, Liet had been terrified, but he had completed the ordeal. Now, though riding a sandworm was every bit as dangerous, and never to be done lightly, he saw the unruly beast as a mode of transportation, a swift means to get him home. Tugging guide ropes and calling back to the riders, Stilgar stood stoically. The Fremen moved spreaders and planted additional maker hooks to direct the creature. Stilgar looked over at Liet, who remained preoccupied and clearly unhappy. He knew his friend's report from Kytane was not good. However, unlike jabbering courtiers in the palace, Fremen were not uneasy with silences. Liet would speak when he was ready, so Stilgar kept to himself beside his friend. They were together, each immersed in his own thoughts. Hours passed as they crossed the desert toward the reddish-black mountains near the horizon. When he felt it was time, attuned to the young planetologist's expressions and watching the reflection of troubled thoughts cross his face beneath the stillsuit mask, Stilgar spoke what Liet needed to hear. "You are the son of Omakynes. Now that your great father has died, you are the hope of all Fremen. And you have my life and loyalty, just as I promised it to your father." Stilgar did not treat the younger man in a paternal fashion, but as a genuine comrade. They both knew the story, it had been told many times in Sich. Before he came to live among the Fremen, Pardut Kynes had fought 6 Harkonnen bravos who had cornered Stilgar, Turok, and Amun, a brash trio of young Fremen. Stilgar was grievously injured, and would have died if Kynes had not helped kill the Baron's men. Subsequently, when the planetologist became a wild prophet of the Fremen, the 3 swore to help him achieve his dream. Even after Amun had died with Pardut in a cave-in at Plaster Basin, Stilgar remembered the water debt he owed, and paid it to the sun, Bleat. Stilgar reached out to clasp the younger man's arm. Bleat was every bit the man his father had been, and more. He had been raised as a Fremen. Bleat gave him a wan smile, his eyes deeply appreciative. "It is not your loyalty that concerns me still, but the practicality of our cause. We will receive neither help nor sympathy from House Carino." Stilgar actually laughed at this. "The Emperor's sympathy is a weapon I'd rather not have. And we need no help killing Harkonnens." Now, as they rode the worm onward, he told his comrade about the raid on the desecrated Sich Hadith. Leet looked pleased. Back in the warm confines of the isolated stronghold, Leet went eagerly to his quarters, dirty and exhausted. There Ferul waited for her husband, and he would spend time with her first. After his sojourn on the Imperial planet, Leet needed a few moments of peace and calm, which his wife had always been able to provide. The desert people were anxious to hear his report, and had already called a gathering for that evening. But, by tradition, no traveler was required to tell his tale until he could be refreshed, except in an emergency. Ferula greeted him with a smile, flashing blue within blue eyes. Her welcoming kiss deepened as the privacy hanging fell across the door to their chamber. She had made him spice coffee and small honeyed melange cakes. He found the treats satisfying, but far less wonderful than simply seeing her again. After another embrace, she brought out their young children, Leet Chi, her son by Leet's best friend Warwick, whose death had left Leet to take care of Ferula and the boy as his own, as well as their own daughter, Chani. He hugged the children, and they played and jabbered, until finally a nursemaid took them away, leaving him alone again with his wife. Ferula smiled, her skin golden. She unfastened his now worthless stillsuit, which had been taken apart and reassembled by the Emperor's security men. She applied thin salves to the bare skin of his feet. Leet let out a long sigh. He had much to do, many matters to discuss with the Fremen, but he pushed them aside for now. Even a man who had stood before the Golden Lion throne could find other things more important. As he looked into his wife's enigmatic eyes, Leet felt more at home than he had at any time since he'd stepped off the guild shuttle in Carthag. "Tell me about the wonders of Kaitain, my love," she said, her expression already filled with awe. "Such beautiful things you must have seen."
"I saw many things there, yes," he answered. "But believe me when I tell you this, Ferula." He stroked his fingers along her cheek. "I have found nothing in all the universe more beautiful than you."
The fate of the known universe hinges upon effective decisions, which can only be made with complete information. Docent Glax Othon of House Talagari. A child's primer on leadership, suitable for adults. One of the least opulent rooms in Castle Caladan, Leto's inner sanctum was a place where a leader would not feel overwhelmed by frivolous gaudiness when pondering the business interests of House Atreides.
The windowless stone walls featured no tapestries. The glow globes were unadorned. A fire in the hearth gave off a sweet, resinous smell, driving back the dampness of cool salt air. For hours, he sat at his battered Tico desk. An ominous message cylinder lay like a time bomb in front of him. He had already read the report his spies had brought him. Did the Tleilaxu actually think they could keep their crimes secret? Or were they simply hoping to complete their despicable desecration and be gone from the Senesar War Memorial before Leto could respond? The Prime Magistrate of Beakal must have known that House Atreides would be deeply offended. Or had the Tleilaxu simply paid such a huge bribe that Beakal could not refuse? All the Imperium seemed to believe the recent tragedies had broken him, snuffed out his flame. He looked at the ducal signet ring on his finger. Leto had never expected to assume the mantle of leadership at the age of 15. Now, after 21 years, he felt as if he had worn the heavy ring for centuries. On the desktop stood a crystal plaz-encased butterfly, its wings bent at an awkward angle. A few years ago, distracted by a document he'd been studying, Leto had accidentally crushed the insect. Now he kept the preserved specimen where he could always be reminded of the consequences of his actions as Duke and as a man. Tleilaxu desecrations of war dead, committed with the blessing of the Prime Magistrate, could not be permitted or forgotten. Duncan Idaho, in full military regalia, knocked on the half-open wooden door. "You summoned me, Leto?" Tall and proud, the Swordmaster carried a slight air of superiority since his return from Ginaz. He had earned his right to be self-confident after enduring 8 years of rigorous Swordmaster training. "Duncan, I value your advice now more than ever." Leto rose to his feet. "I face a grim decision, and I must discuss strategy with you, now that Thufir and Gurney have gone to Ix." The young man brightened, eager for the opportunity to prove his military worth. "Are we ready to plan our next move on Ix?" "This is another matter." Leto held up the message cylinder, then sighed. "As Duke, I found that there is always another matter." Jessica stepped silently into the open doorway. Though she had the ability to eavesdrop unnoticed, she stood boldly beside the Swordmaster. "May I hear these concerns as well, my Duke?" Normally, Leto would not have allowed a concubine to join in strategy sessions, but Jessica had extraordinary training, and he had come to value her perspective. She had given him her strength and her love during his darkest hour, and he would not dismiss her lightly. Leto summarized how Tleilaxu excavation teams had set up a large encampment on Beakal. Stone ziggurats, overgrown with vegetation, marked where Atreides' troops had fought alongside their Vernius counterparts to rescue the planet from a pirate flotilla. The war dead included thousands of soldiers, as well as the fallen patriarchs of both houses. Leto's voice became ominously hushed. "Tleilaxu exhumation teams are removing the bodies of our ancestors, claiming they wish to study them for historical genetics." Duncan pounded his fist against the wall. "By the blood of Jewel Narette, we must prevent them." Jessica bit her lower lip. "It is obvious what they want, my Duke. I don't understand the process completely, but it is possible that even with cadavers mummified for centuries, the Tleilaxu can grow golas from dead cells. They may be able to reproduce a lost Atreides or Vernius genetic line." Leto stared at the plaz-encased butterfly. "That's why they wanted Victor's body, and Romber's." "Precisely." If I take the accepted approach, I must travel to Kaitain and lodge a formal protest in the Landsraad. Investigative committees may be formed, and eventually Beakal and the Tleilaxu might receive some form of censure. By then it would be too late! Duncan's alarm was apparent. A log popped in the fireplace, startling them all. That is why I have decided to take more extreme action. Jessica tried to insert the voice of reason. Would it be possible to send our own troops to seize and remove the rest of the bodies before the Tleilaxu can exhume them? Not good enough, Leto said. If we overlook even one, our efforts will be in vain. No, we must eliminate the temptation, erase the problem, and send a clear message. Those who think Duke Leto Atreides has grown weak are about to learn otherwise. Leto looked at the strewn documents that summarized his troop strength, the weapons in his armory, the available warcraft, even the family atomics. Thufir is not here, so this will be your chance to prove yourself, Duncan. We must deliver a lesson that cannot be interpreted in any other way. No warning, no mercy, no ambiguity. I shall be glad to lead such a mission, my Duke. In this universe, there is no such thing as a safe place or a safe way. Danger lies along every path. Zensuni Aphorism. Over the night side of Ix, a scheduled cargo shuttle dropped from the hold of an orbiting highliner. From the uninhabited wilderness, a hidden Sardaukar observation post watched the craft's orange plume as it descended into their detection grid. The shuttle headed toward the port of entry canyon, the guarded access point to the subterranean capital city. Sardaukar observers did not notice a second, much smaller craft slipping into its wake. An Atreides combat pod. By virtue of a heavy bribe, the Highliner was fitted with a camouflage signal transmitter that tricked the ground-based trackers so that the black, unlit shape could move undetected, long enough for Gurney Halleck and Thufir Hawat to slip underground. Gurney worked the controls of the tiny wingless craft. Taking a different trajectory from the shuttle's plume, the black Atreides pod sped low across the rugged northern landscape. Lightless onboard instruments whispered data into his headset, telling him how to avoid the guarded landing cradles. Gurney used daredevil skills he had learned from Dominic Vernius in a smuggler's band, streaking over boulder fields, skimming close to glaciers and high cirques. When he hauled contraband cargoes, he had known how to elude Carino security patrols, and now he remained beneath the detection level of the Tleilaxu security net. As the pod jostled through the atmosphere, Thufir sat placidly in Mentat mode, weighing possibilities. He had recorded all of the emergency exits and secret routes Romber had managed to remember. But human concerns kept breaking his concentration. Although Leto had never criticized him for what might have been interpreted as security breaches, the death of Duke Paulus in the Bullring, the Sky Clipper disaster, Thufir had redoubled his efforts, calling upon every skill in his personal arsenal, and adding more. Now he and Gurney had to infiltrate the besieged cities of Ix, ferret out weaknesses, and prepare for an outright military action. After the recent tragedies, Duke Leto was no longer afraid to bloody his hands. When Leto decided it was time, House Atreides would strike, and strike hard. Kater Pilru, a resistance fighter with whom they had long been in contact, had refused to abandon his efforts on Ix, despite crackdowns by the Tleilaxu invaders. Using stolen materials, he had fashioned effective bombs and other weapons, and, for a time, had even received secret assistance from Prince Romber. until all contact had been lost. Thufir hoped they could find Kater again this night, while there was still time. He and Gurney, acting on a few shreds of possibilities and a likely meeting place, had tried to send messages underground. Using an old Vernius military code that only Kater would know, supplied by Romber, the warrior Mentat had proposed a possible rendezvous in the honeycomb of secret routes and hidden chambers. But the Atreides infiltrators had received no confirmation. They were flying blind, led only by hope and determination. Thufir gazed through the pod's small windows to get his bearings, contemplating how they would go about finding the Ixion freedom fighters. Though it was not part of any Mentat analysis, he feared they would need to depend on luck. Huddling in a musty storeroom in the upper crustal levels of what had once been the Grand Palais, Kater Pilru harbored his own doubts. He had received the message, decoded it, and didn't believe it. His small-scale guerrilla war had continued for years and years, not always because of victories and hope, but because of sheer determination. Fighting the Tleilaxu comprised Kater's entire life, and he did not know who he was or what he would be if the struggle ever ended. He had survived this long by trusting no one in the once beautiful underground city. He changed identities, moved from place to place, struck as hard as he could and then fled, leaving the invaders and their Sardaukar guard dogs in angry confusion. As a favorite mental exercise, he pictured the original city in his mind, the gossamer connecting walkways and streets between stalactite buildings. He even envisioned the Ixion people, as they used to be, filled with cheer and purpose, before the grim reality of the Tleilaxu invasion set in. But now it all blurred in his memory. It had been so long. A short while ago he had found the communication. A trick? From representatives of Prince Romber Vernius. Kater's entire life had been a risk, and now he had to take the chance. He knew that as long as Romber lived, the prince would never abandon his people. In the cold darkness of the storeroom, waiting, Kater wondered if he was in fact losing his hold on reality, especially now that he knew the terrible fate of Miral Alekhem, his lover and comrade, who might have become his wife under different circumstances. But the filthy invaders had captured her, used her body for their mysterious, awful experiments. He resisted visualizing Miral the way he had last seen her. An abomination. A brain-dead shape hooked up and converted into some hideous biological factory. With every breath he took, he cursed the Tleilaxu for their cruelties. He squeezed his dark, haunted eyes shut, controlled his breathing, and remembered only Miral's large eyes, her narrow, attractive face, her raggedly cropped hair. Rage, near suicidal despondency, and survivor's guilt washed through him. He had set his mind on a fanatical course, but if Prince Romber had truly sent men to aid him, this nightmare might soon be over. A sudden loud whir of machinery made him scramble deeper into the shadows. He heard quiet scratchings, the skilled picking of a lock, then the hatch of a self-guided lift chamber opening to reveal two silhouetted figures. They hadn't seen him yet. He could still flee, or try to kill them. But they were too tall to beat Tleilaxu, and did not move like Sardaukar. The older man looked tough as shiga wire, with a sinewy face and the sappho-stained lips of a Mentat. His burly blonde companion, a lumpy man with a prominent scar on his face, pocketed a small set of tools. The Mentat stepped out of the lift first, exuding wary confidence. "We come from Caladan." Kater didn't move or reveal himself. His heart raced. It might still be a trick, but he'd come this far. He had to find out for sure. His fingers touched the hilt of a hand-wrought dagger in his pocket. "I am here." Gatari emerged from the shadows, and the two men looked toward him, eyes adjusting to the low illumination. "We are friends of your prince. You are no longer alone," said the scarred man. Moving cautiously, as if stepping on broken glass, the trio met in the center of the dusty storage room. They clasped hands in the half-handshake of the Imperium, made awkward introductions. The new arrivals told him what had happened to Romber. Kater looked dazed, not certain anymore where reality and his fantasies separated. "There was a girl. Kylia?" "Yes, Kylia Vernius." Thufir and Gurney looked at each other, avoided the uncomfortable revelation for now. "We don't have much time," Gurney said. "We need to see and learn what we can." Kater faced the two Atreides representatives, trying to decide where to begin. Raw anger built inside, filling him with so much emotion that he could not bear to tell them what he had already seen, what he'd already endured here. "Stay, and I will show you what the Tleilaxu have done to Ix." Unobtrusively, the three men moved through crowds of oppressed workers, past facilities that had degenerated into decrepitude. They used Kater's numerous stolen identification cards to enter and exit security zones. This lone rebel had learned how to pass unnoticed, and the downtrodden Ixians rarely looked at anything other than their own feet. "We've known for some time that the Emperor is involved here," Thufir said, "but I cannot understand the necessity for two full legions of Sardaukar." "Seen, but I still don't know the answers." Kater pointed out a sluggish monstrosity lumbering across a loading dock, a machine with a few human components strapped on, a battered head, part of a bruised and misshapen torso. "If Prince Romber is a cyborg, I pray it's nothing like what the Tleilaxu have created here." Gurney was appalled. "What sort of demon is that?" "By Ixians. Victims of torture and execution. Reanimated through machinery. They aren't alive, just mobile. The Tleilaxu call them examples. They are toys for the amusement of demented minds." Thufir stood dispassionately, mentally filing away every detail, while Gurney had trouble controlling the revulsion on his face. Kater managed a grim smile. "I saw one with a paint sprayer strapped to his back, but the thing's biomechanics broke down and stopped moving altogether. He had the sprayer full on when he fell, and two Tleilaxu masters got doused with pigment. They were furious, shouting gibberish at the machine thing, as if it had done it intentionally." "Maybe it did," Gurney said. In the ensuing days, the trio investigated and observed, and hated what they saw. Gurney wanted to fight right away, but Thufir advised caution. They needed to go back and report to House Atreides. Only then, with the Duke's permission, could they formulate a plan for an effective, coordinated assault. "We'd like to take you back with us, Kater," Gurney offered, compassion plain on his face. "We can get you out of here. You have already suffered enough." Kater was alarmed at the suggestion. "I'm not leaving. I wouldn't know what to do if I stopped fighting. My place is here, tormenting the invaders any way I can, letting my surviving countrymen know I haven't given up, and never will." "Prince Romber thought you might say that," Thufir said. "We have brought many supplies for you in our combat pod. Explosive wafers, weapons, even food stores. It is a start." Kater felt dizzy with the possibilities. "I knew my prince hadn't given up on us. I have awaited his return for so long, hoping to fight side by side with him." "We will take our report to Duke Leto Atreides and to your prince. Be patient." Thufir wanted to say more, to promise something tangible, but he did not have the authority to do so. Keter nodded, anxious to begin anew. At last, after so many years, powerful forces might aid him in his fight. Compassion and revenge are two sides of the same coin. Necessity dictates which way that coin falls. Duke Paulus Atreides. Steam rose from the lush foliage of Baikal as the yellow-orange primary sun lifted above the horizon. The bright, white secondary star already rode high in the sky. Dayflowers opened with a gush of perfume, calling to birds and insects. Bristly primates ran through the dense canopy, and predatory vines curled out to snag unsuspecting rodents. Atop the overgrown Senesar Plateau, gigantic marble ziggurats stood tall, their corners faceted with scooped mirrors that directed sun flares like spotlights in all directions. On this plateau, besieged Atreides and Vernius men had once fought multitudes of raiders, slaying at least 10 for every defender lost, before being overwhelmed by sheer numbers. They had sacrificed themselves to the last man, only an hour before the long-awaited reinforcement troops arrived and crushed the remaining pirates. For centuries, the Baikali people had revered those fallen heroes. But after House Vernius had gone renegade in shame, the Prime Magistrate had ceased tending the monuments, allowing the jungle foliage to smother them. The statues became nesting places for small animals and birds. The great stone blocks began to crack and weather, and no one on Baikal cared. In recent days, self-erecting tents had sprouted like geometric fungi around the fringes of the memorial. Teams of workers had cut down thick underbrush, removing decades of jungle debris, scraping down to the stones and unearthing the sealed tombs. Thousands of dead soldiers lay buried in mass graves on the mesa. Others were sealed in armored crypts inside the ziggurats. Baikali supervisors had provided excavation equipment to disassemble the jagged ziggurats block by block. Small-statured Tleilaxu scientists set up modular laboratories, eager to test the cell scrapings from any exhumed bodies, dredging through the remnants of human tissue to find viable genetic material. The jungle smelled of mist and flowers, pungent oils from dark green plants, herbs that grew as tall as trees. Smoke from the encampments and the thick exhaust of heavy machinery curled into the air. One of the gnomish excavators wiped sweat from his brow and flailed his hand to drive away clouds of blood-sucking gnats. He looked up to watch the flame-orange primary sun rise over the canopy like an angry eye. Suddenly the sky lit up with purple lasgun beams. Led by Duncan Idaho, Atreides' ships descended from orbit, targeting the isolated war memorial. He transmitted Duke Leto's message even as he opened fire. The recorded speech would be heard by the Prime Magistrate in the Baikali capital city. A separate copy had been sent by courier to the Landsrad Council on Kaitain, all according to the strictures of warfare laid down by the Great Convention. Leto's iron-hard voice announced, "The Senesar War Memorial was established in honor of the service my ancestors performed for Baikal. Now the Beni Tleilax and the Baikali have desecrated this place. House Atreides has no recourse but to respond appropriately. We shall not allow our fallen heroes to be defiled by cowards. Therefore, we choose to erase this monument." At the lead of a phalanx of warships, Duncan Idaho gave his troops permission to open fire. Lasgun beams sliced through the partially dismantled ziggurats, exposing long-sealed chambers. Tleilaxu scientists ran screaming from tents and laboratory shelters. In doing so, we have followed the forms precisely, Leto's recorded voice continued. It is unfortunate that some casualties may be suffered, but we take solace in the knowledge that only those engaged in criminal activity will be harmed. There are no innocents in this matter. The Atreides fleet circled and dropped thermal bombs, then shot purple blasts of light into the conflagration. In 20 standard minutes, faster than it took the Prime Magistrate to call a meeting of his advisers, the squadron had leveled the memorial, the Tleilaxu grave robbers, and their Beakali collaborators. It also vaporized all the remaining Atreides and Vernius dead. The plateau was left an uneven plain of melted glass, punctuated by lumps of smoking material. All along the fringes of the attack zone, fires grew brighter and hotter, spreading outward into the jungle. "House Atreides tolerates no insult," Duncan said into the comm system. But there were no survivors to listen. As he gave the order for his ships to return to orbit, he looked down at the devastation. After this, no one in the Imperium would ever question Duke Leto's resolve. No warning, no mercy, no ambiguity. The enemy to be feared most is one who wears the face of a friend. Swordmaster Rebek of Ginaz. Underground on Kytane, the Imperial necropolis covered as much area as the magnificent palace itself. Generations of fallen Corinos inhabited the city of the dead, those who had succumbed to treachery or accidents. A few had even died of natural causes. When Count Hasimir Fenring returned from Ix, Shaddam immediately led his friend and advisor into the dank, poorly lit catacombs. "Is this how you celebrate the triumphant return of your spice minister? By dragging me down into musty old crypts, Shaddam had dispensed with his usual retinue of bodyguards, and the two men were accompanied only by tethered orange glow-globes as they descended spiraling stairs. "We used to play down here as children, Hasimir. It gives me nostalgic feelings." Fenring nodded his overlarge head. His wide eyes flicked from side to side like those of a nocturnal bird, searching for assassins and booby traps. "Perhaps this is where I developed my fascination for lurking in shadows." Shaddam's voice became harder, more imperial. "It's also a place where we can speak without fear of being spied upon. You and I have important matters to discuss." Fenring grunted in approval. Long ago, after moving the imperial capital from ruined Seleucus Secundus, Hasic Corino III had been the first to be entombed beneath the megalithic building. Over the ensuing millennia, numerous Corino emperors, concubines, and bastard children were also buried here.